Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist. Today we have a special episode for you with Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell is one of the foremost researchers on the exotic technology that the Nazis developed and kept hidden from the world. Dr. Farrell will give us a deep overview on Die Glocke, the Nazi bell, a Nazi torsion physics project with major implications, and also the tantalizing link of Nazi tech to the Roswell UFO incident. Is there a missing advanced technology chapter in our history up to the present? Let's go ask Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Yeah, they're going to roll all that stuff up. I mean, they're already throwing Fauci to the wolves. Not that he doesn't deserve it, but
they are. This is really interesting. They threw Gates to the wolves, but only for a sex thing, like not for the real thing.
Right. Right?
Cuomo, he was another one who got the wolf treatment. Should we talk about this?
Oh, you can if you want to, but all those people are just, you know, they're so disgusting, I'd rather not even think about them.
I hear you. Interesting that they're disposable.
Well, they're disposable because they no longer need that kind of network.
Oh. Right.
Too much overhead, too much analog technology. They don't need it anymore. That's the only reason I can think of that they're rolling it up. They've got better means of tracking now.
Fascinating. You know, I do all the hot zone investigations, and it's always Bimini, Nassau, Cuba. Everything seems to go on down there. It's like an incredible triangle. But Autech is down there.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Autech is down there. You know where they are? They're in Andros. And Andros is largely abandoned. I mean, but it's much bigger than Bimini or somewhere. In Bimini, at least you have a native population. You have people. There's almost nobody on
Andros. Interesting.
Yeah. So I thought, well, if they're going to do the false flag underwater in the Bahamas, you just have Autech run it.
Sure. Sure. Why not? Yeah. We could start a company called Zapata Oil and base it on a little island about 90 miles from Cuba and run ships named Barbara. You know, we could do all sorts of stuff.
You know what? I went back to a weird book, Russ Baker's Bush book, the family book on them, and all the Kennedy stuff. It might as well be a Kennedy book. Amazing.
Yeah. He's up to his earlobes with it.
Yes.
Up to his earlobes with it. I have less use for that family than I do the Clintons.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I see Jeb starting to kind of get his profile out there again.
Oh, yeah. Well, he hasn't got my vote. Pardon me. God,
the pits. I like that Florida governor, DeSantis.
DeSantis?
Yeah.
I'm reserving my verdict on him. He's made all the right moves, but you know, I get immensely suspicious of politicians when they start doing all the right things.
Yeah, right. I want to bring up that they're using Rubio as the point man for this UAP thing. That's very interesting.
Yes, it's very interesting to me too, for all the reasons that you and I probably both know. his little bubble bath episode, for example.
Extracurricular activities.
The extracurricular activities, yes.
I had this piece from your tome, Roswell and the Reich here, which is incredible going back to now, considering everything they're doing. But I remember that you said that Philip Corso, that he would write in some things about the UFO file, and then there'd be a Nazi thing sort of to underline it. And it was like, if you can catch the reference, good for you. I'm moving on. You say something, I caught something like that in here with Stanton Friedman talking about Donald Menzel, which I always thought was interesting. And MJ-12 came up because now Lou Elizondo is talking about, he's like, oh, I know all about MJ-12. And so I was like, this is interesting to revisit because the thing you have here, it's page 300. And you're talking about how it looks like Friedman had knowledge about things about Menzel beyond what he wrote. And then it says, however, there's one significant fact that argues strongly against Friedman's involvement in any nefarious activity. And it is one that Friedman himself has never brought up, nor is ever likely to. As was seen in the previous chapter, one of the alleged members of the Eisenhower briefing documents list of MJ-12 group members was General Montague. And the commanding general of Fort Bliss, home to many of the most of the paperclip Nazis and Nazi rocket expert Wernher von Braun's rocket team. This part, this whole thing jumped out at me.
Yeah.
And I guess my question was, do you think that Friedman was trying to insert something in there that people would run after?
He may have been, because I think Friedman was, as far as anybody in the UFO field could be, was more or less faultlessly well informed. And if he wasn't, his arguments or his guesses as to what was going on are usually pretty good. I mean, the whole business of how he uncovered Menzel's real connections and what he really thought as opposed to what he publicly said. I think it's very possible that Friedman may have been doing that. Because his public denunciations of any involvement of Nazi tech in this really don't make any sense. He was too smart.
Right.
Ultimately, to hold some of those views and hold them genuinely. So, you know, and I don't fault him for that, because he's working and writing at a time when it's very difficult to get any coherence on the UFO subject.
Right.
And he's one of the few people that's trying to do it. You know, I may disagree with him on a lot of points, and I do, but at least he kept his wits about him, you know, on a lot of that stuff.
Yes, absolutely. He gave us the key understanding on the MJ-12 piece.
Yes, yes.
Also, when you look at these people now who float around, you know, like filmmakers with Bob Lazar and all that,
yeah,
you realize that Stan had a lot more integrity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, way, way beyond the current crop. Way beyond.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you think of the MJ-12 documents, he went through them with a fine-tooth comb, and he made, I think, a very good case for at least that early batch of MJ-12 documents being authentic. You know, I may disagree with him on it. That's fine. But he made a good case, and he argued his points. You know, he went into detail, and that's what I like about the man. He went in and said, here's the corroborative detail for my hypothesis.
Right.
And you can't fault that. That's what a good researcher does.
Exactly. If you were to give us kind of a synopsis, like I view a number of your books as like hit albums, and then in the middle of that is Roswell and the Reich, which is more like a cult classic. it's a different spin on a lot of things. It's rich with information. It's an incredibly lengthy book. You have something like 500 pages here. Can you, since Roswell is a piece of all this that they're bringing up now, this was a major thesis you brought forward on a Nazi connection to the Roswell incident. What is it about the Nazi connection that you could summarize for us?
Well, the way I view it, you know, I set the book up as an examination of the two basic stories about Roswell. The first basic story, which is the earliest out of the gate by far, is recovery of some sort of exotic technology. Okay. The second story, which occurs 3 decades or so after the event, is the story about the bodies. Okay.
Right.
So I look at it that way, and I have always suspected, Daniel, looking at Roswell, that given what we're told was that had crashed there, and then given the almost immediate reversal of opinion with weather balloons, and the idea that an intelligence officer of an atomic bomb group, no less, doesn't know the difference between a piece of equipment and a weather balloon.
Right. You know,
I'm sorry. I don't think Major Marcel was that stupid. You know, otherwise, he wouldn't have been in the position he was in.
It was not anything from this Earth that I'm quite sure of. Because I was, being an intelligence officer, I was familiar with just about all materials used in aircraft and in our air travel. This is nothing like that. It could not be. It could not have been.
But the way I look at it is that, okay, let's assume that something Nazi did crash and that they recovered this thing. Number one, is the Air Force going to admit that something Nazi crashes? Well, no, it's not, and for two reasons. If it's our Nazis that crashed it, then they don't want classified material or technology or information getting out. And if it's not our Nazis that crashed there, and it's somebody else's Nazis crashed there, then they've got an even bigger problem, right, especially if they suspect that it might be something of an ongoing post-war Nazi project, much less an independent one. And let's remember, this is a few months after Byrd gives his warning, okay?
Yes.
So what are they going to do? Well, they're going to cover it up, number one, because the war is supposed to be over, and yet here they are flying around in our airspace. And, you know, what are they doing here? And number two, do they have any connection with the Nazis we've already got here? And yep, if so, what is it? They are going to clamp down on that like nobody's business. And so the way I read it, Daniel, is they created 3 cover stories. The first was the flying saucer cover story, which is not exactly the way it was reported initially. The second was the weather balloon. And then the third was the bodies.
Right.
Okay, so you've got a 3-layer cover story to get people from looking at the details themselves and trying to rationalize the details. That's basically it in a nutshell.
Got it. And if you had advanced Nazi technology flying around in American skies 2 years after the war was over, and we thought, hey, the Nazis have been defeated. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are elements in the government who understood that people like Hans Kammler had slipped away.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think was the shockwave Nazi-wise? Do you think that this whole part of the national security apparatus became aware? Oh.
We've got a problem?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they did. There has been a recent study of Kammler where the authors conclude that he actually came to this country, and they make a very good case for it.
Wow.
So if that's in the mix, then yeah, there's even more of a reason to keep the Roswell thing quiet. Now, my problem with the Kammler in America narrative is that the people that maintain this never go to Argentina and see what they say.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, you know, you notice the complete lack of reference to all of that. And as far as I'm concerned, the stories are connected somehow.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on down there, what's going on up here, and so on and so forth. But yeah, if Kammler's in that mix, they would have had to have kept it quiet, absolutely quiet.
Okay.
And they did, you know. And one of the things about Roswell and the Reich I also mentioned was a story that Whitley Strieber put me onto of a man that had appeared, a doctor who took care of terminally ill people, who appeared on Coast to Coast and mentioned that one of the patients that he had in his care said that what had crashed was Nazi, complete with, you know, the Balkenkreuz, the German cross that was on their aircraft and so on, which I thought was very interesting. I don't base my argument on it, but it's an interesting little detail to add to the mix.
Fascinating. Do you think that, what would they be doing flying over New Mexico?
Looking at our defense installations, taking pictures. And there's an interesting episode that Linda Hunt recounts in her book Secret Agenda that goes into the paperclip Nazis and so on. When the Nazis were firing off the V-2s for the Army and, you know, basically teaching us how to launch big rockets. And one incident was one of these V-2s was shot into Juarez, Mexico.
Wow.
And landed in Juarez, creating an international incident, needless to say. You know, why are you Americans bombing our country with rockets? But the other thing that she mentioned that I found extremely interesting was some of those V-2s had cameras in the nose cone.
Oh.
And as the nose cone was in the descent stage, you know, it's clicking away on our installations, and we'd send our people out to recover these cameras, and
the cameras were gone.
The cameras were gone.
Wow.
And then we get the reopening of Davis's file. And Hunt mentions in her book that the American Army counterintelligence noticed the Germans were living way beyond their salary, like, you know, driving around in brand new Mercedes, going to dead drops over the Mexican border, that they had another source of income from, you know, God knows where.
Wow.
And, you know, so that indicates that they weren't so much our Nazis as maybe just sort of our Nazis. On and on it goes.
You make a really good point, which is that they actually reconnected their command structure from the Nazi days. That is really unnerving.
Totally. They're in all the exact same positions doing the exact same things that they were doing in Peenemünde for General Dornberger. So they reproduced the command structure.
Incredible.
So no wonder at a certain point Arthur Rudolph just gets fed up and says, well, let's just build this dang thing, this booster, in-house by ourselves. You know, we can do it. And bypass all of these American companies and this endless contract process and so on and so forth. So that, you know, that's why I'm very curious about Kazing's book. I want to read that book and see what he has to say. Because where's that money going?
You know? Yes, absolutely. Hans Kammler, you determined, was largely in charge of the Bell research. Mm-hmm. He was one of the main guys. When the Allies are approaching, he decides we have to eliminate these Bell scientists, is the mm-hmm. story, and he kills them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that happened?
I do. Simply because they need to get all of that documentation. They can't let it fall into the hands of the Russians, which I think probably was Kammler's big concern at that point in the war. Incidentally, I just did an interview with Tino von Struckmann, who went to Lower Silesia and took a video tour of all those installations. You should watch it.
Wow. Yeah.
You will see things that will boggle your mind.
That's amazing.
It's unbelievable, and including very clear evidence of very heavy electrical cabling in some of the installations. I mean, it's mind-boggling, the size of these things. But anyway, Kammler, you know, in my view, Kammler is one of these Nazis that dies under mysterious circumstances several times.
Right.
Yeah. in Kammler's case, he dies under four different circumstances. So in other words, the narrative of these deaths, Kammler, Gestapo Miller, Martin Bormann, even Hitler himself to a degree, is so badly obfuscated that to me it looks like another op. You know, where did they go? Did they die? Did they die here? Did they die there? It's classic intelligence obfuscation of data.
Absolutely. Where do you think Hans Kammler actually went, and where do you think the Bell technology went?
I think Argentina. All of the circumstantial indicators to me, and this is why I wrote Nazi International with Richter and so on down there, and all the detailed connections between his work and the Bell. Richter's getting his equipment from the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, German General Electric. He's doing experiments in rotating plasma by his own say-so. That's the Bell. He's got people on his team that are into this very weird stuff. He maintains that he started this plasma research in Nazi Germany. In other words, what he's doing for Juan Perón is a continuation of it. So you've got those little details. Then you have, and this is something that, again, I wish people that investigated this story would at least consider the Argentine side of it. Because there's a researcher by the name of Jeffrey Brooks who lives in Buenos Aires. He and I were in contact years and years ago when I was doing those books. And he maintains that Argentinians told him that the one of the missing Junkers 390s, those big six-engine long-range aircraft, had flown into an airfield in Argentina. And they took off whatever cargo was on that plane, and then they dismantled the plane. I mean, this is a gigantic aircraft. You know? It's huge. You've seen pictures of it. And interestingly enough, I had a friend that went on Google Maps and looked at that area of Argentina and sent me a picture of one of these Google Map. Pardon me, I've got the hiccups. Google Map things that they'd found. And there's this big grassy area that is literally the remains of a large runway in southern Argentina in the middle of nowhere that, you know, would have been perfectly capable of accepting a plane like a Junkers 390. I mean, this thing is, you know, the prop engine version of a jumbo jet. I mean, it's just enormous.
Wow.
So, yeah, I still think that a lot of the Bell documentation, if not the device itself, was taken out of Nazi Germany or at least disassembled and maybe put back together in some other place. I just don't see it making its way to this country. Kammler himself may have, because he was not only in charge of the Bell project, but I should add that by the end of the war, he was in charge of every last scrap of German secret research. The V-2s, the television missiles, the acoustic homing torpedoes, you know, all of it. He was in charge of it.
Amazing. He's the central figure.
He's the central figure, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. In a nutshell, I know you've done extensive work about the Bell and what it can do, but in a nutshell, what is it?
Well, in my reading of it, what I basically did in SS Brotherhood of the Bell is I took Igor Vitkovsky's book and went through all the details that he mentions in the book to see if I could try to reverse engineer what might have been the thinking behind the device, okay? So we've got rotating plasma and so on and so forth, and a claim that it would levitate. Now, I personally believe the claim for the sake of argument, because it's very important to note what it did not do. In Vitkovsky's reading, the Bell had to remain attached to its power source through electrical cables. It consumed gobs of electricity. And it was tethered, therefore, at all times when it was tested outdoors, if you accept his story, when it was tested outdoors, and all it would do was levitate. Okay? In other words, it did not zap around the sky and perform intricate maneuvers and so on and so forth. It just levitated. That's all it did, which is significant enough in itself because it's, you know, if you read Vitkovsky's description, which I go through in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell and subsequent books, is significant enough because you've got clear evidence that the Germans are, number one, working on an alternative source of energy. Number two, are working on an alternative source of propulsion, right, which in this case looks to be some sort of field propulsion. And if they can get that technology perfected so that it can go zipping around the sky, then so much the better. But this is, you know, I'll be blunt, Daniel. This is the reason why I say that there's no secret Nazi UFO base in Antarctica. Because the only technology which for which there is a reasonable amount of evidence that appears to be something exotic is this bell. Mm-hmm. And number one, it's not behaving like a UFO. And number two, it has to have an entire power plant in order to work. Mm-hmm. And the Nazis just were not capable of sustaining a secret UFO base in Antarctica, much less building it.
Right.
You know, with the German Navy in World War II, tiny little Navy that it was, which was, you know, obviously a thorn in everybody's side. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. you know, this is beyond their capacity. So right. I've never bought the story for that reason and that reason alone. But that's basically what the bell did.
Fascinating. And the bell, we didn't find out about it till 1990 with the reunification of Germany.
Right.
Which is significant because it's off the history books there for about 45 years.
Uh-huh.
What do you think became of the technology?
I suspect that the technology itself ultimately fell into American and Russian hands, but not initially. But I suspect that there was enough of a document trail. I mean, Jakob Spornberg, the only reason we know about the bell is an SS general by the name of Jakob Spornberg, who was tried for war crimes in Poland after the war for shooting the 60 scientists. And allegedly, this is the affidavit where he lays out the bell. So in other words, you have a Warsaw Pact member country that had access to at least the information about it, and that means the Russians did. So even if the Russians don't have the device, they've got enough information there to do basically what I did and maybe reverse engineer a process of thinking and conceptualization behind it to investigate themselves. So do I think they would have done that? Sure, you betcha they would have. And mm-hmm. would we have? Sure, you betcha we would have.
Do you think that the what they could be using for all of these sightings that they're promoting right now with this task force and everything, could they have taken a process, instead of redeveloping a UFO, which may have been very difficult, could they have taken a process like the bell to create the illusion of UFO sightings and things of this nature?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, let's just take the case of triangular UFOs, okay? Yeah. When that became all the rage many years ago after Art Bell talked about it on Coast to Coast AM, everybody was jumping on the ET bandwagon, you remember, with those yes. things.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a friend actually contact me when I was at David Childress's headquarters in Majestic metropolitan area downtown Kempton, Illinois, next to the grain silos. And he said, well, these things are clearly ET technology. I said, nonsense. I said, all you need is a big gas bag, like a dirigible, and charge the plates, the leading plates, with an electrical charge and create an electrical dipole around this thing, and it'll move, and you provide the lift with the gas bag. That's all you need.
Wow.
And he kind of reared back and says, oh, yeah, I never thought of that. And, you know, to me, many of these things probably are human technology, but again, people are being conditioned to think, oh, it's ET, and they go zooming off so fast. Well, a dipole will do that for you if you know how to control it. Just put some batteries on the thing. You've got lots of lift, and off you go. And they can hover, too, you know.
Right, you know, yeah.
That's what dirigibles do.
Good point.
So,
do you think that is there a way to tell the difference between ET technology and the kind of let's say, left over from advanced Nazi projects that have been reconditioned through an American development program?
Well, you're asking the epistemological question. And this is what upsets me with people that look at these videos from the space shuttle or the International Space Station, and you see these little donut things with spiraling energy going through them and holes in the middle and so on, and they fade into existence. They literally pop into view or pop out of view. All right. My problem with this is, again, this need not be an extraterrestrial signature. It could be a signature of stealth technology being turned on and off and so on. So, in other words, it's very difficult to tell the difference between some of the technology, not all of it, but some of it, just on the basis of reports or film. You'd actually have to go in and look at the nuts and bolts of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think of Mark McCandless, who sadly passed away recently with his alien reconstruction vehicle. Well, this is an entirely human thing he's talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the story. And again, you're dealing with things that in some respects resemble the way I tried to conceptualize or reverse engineer the thought process behind the bell. You're dealing with very, very similar concepts. So, you know, it's very difficult to tell the difference. You'd have to get in and actually look at it.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And when you hear about some of those earlier cases where they saw crashes and they would look in and they would see, there's like control panels and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like us testing out a type of technology that has created the same type of thing.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it seems plausible for the I think about actually the story that Philip Corso tells about how Dornberger developed the X-15, mm-hmm. which is still the fastest manned plane, space mm-hmm. plane. Even though it was 1961, somehow, you know, 60 years later, it still holds the record. He said they were built for chasing UFOs.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Yeah.
I can believe that. You have reports of Dr. Walter Lippisch, one of the paperclip Nazis that was brought over to Wright-Patterson, who was working on German ramjets during the war. And Lippisch was adamant that the sound barrier had been broken during the war, during one of those test flights of one of these ramjet aircraft. So move over, Chuck Yeager. You know, you were a little late to the game. But yeah, I can believe that. I can believe that very easily.
Fascinating. You know, I wanted to point this out to you. There's a group that studies these X planes and their crashes and how the sites become completely off limits, mm-hmm. and, you know, shoot on site kind of thing. Nobody ever mm-hmm. gets to check it out. But somebody had apparently taken a picture of some of these X planes, one of them that had crashed, and had arrived mm-hmm. there first and taken some pictures. And they actually found this little packet with an X on it. I had no idea what it was. And I was like, you know, it just gave me this thought, like, wouldn't it be interesting if with the X technology, they just found a way to make it, you know what, here's our super plane and we tag on this little X patch and boom. Uh-huh. But I think it is interesting that there's a whole class of technology through that period of the 50s and 60s that's secret. We have a number of UFO sightings. We have UFO cases. We have people arm in arm with aliens and everything else. And here we are 50, 60 years later, and they're trying to lay it on us as if, oh, you know, it's Kenneth Arnold just saw some UFOs in December 2017, and we figured out it's a threat. I mean, they've regressed us out of 70, 80 years of knowledge.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's the clever thing about this. It's not only a marketing operation, but it's an alteration of historical memory.
Yes.
That they're pushing on people, you know. Yes. Oh, we're all of a sudden confronted with this, you know, horse pocky. You know, this has been going on ever since the end of the war, and anybody who's halfway knowledgeable in the field of ufology will tell you this. Walter Bosley, my friend Walter Bosley, just did a video a couple weeks ago where he was tearing into the mainstream media and all the hoopla that the ufology crowd is giving all of these reports now, and pulling up articles from the 70s, from the 60s, from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, you know, about UFOs. So he says, you know, this is nothing new, and it isn't anything new.
Absolutely. You know,
it's a marketing operation, and it's a psychological operation to make people think, oh, all of a sudden now the military is interested. Come on.
Yeah, wow. Right. And it's all because Lou had to make sure that, you know, they wouldn't listen to him because they don't care about the threat of UFOs.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely.
This is amazing, too, because what a ridiculous narrative. You know, mm-hmm. we know that they're afraid of, you know, they watch for threats. They manufacture threats and all the rest. There's no way they're going to ignore a threat. It's absurd.
No.
And that's why the whole ATIP farce is also absurd. And there's been a lot of inconsistencies around that, including the fact that Harry Reid is in the middle of it.
Well, look, again, I think they're rolling this out now because they need some sort of external threat.
Yeah.
That will justify their plans for space, will justify their plans for, you know, global government, which, you know, is not going to float. I'm sorry, you know, This is the old dream from Alexander the Great on down. It always comes a cropper.
Mm-hmm. I guess the dangerous thing is the attempt.
Yeah.
Because we're caught in the crosshairs of it.
Yeah.
I mentioned Harry Reid. And so to wrap up, I'm going to mention the other senator that they're putting forward on all of this now, Marco Rubio. Senator of Florida, former presidential candidate.
Dubio Rubio. I mean, this guy is an intellectual lightweight. I mean, he is. I mean, the soap bubble bath episode is enough, you know, as far as I'm concerned. And this guy is on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And what does that tell you?
Yeah, right.
Not much intelligence to be found there between him and Dianne Feinstein. But anyway.
All right.
It's an operation. You know, he's the perfect one to trot out for this sort of stuff. And again, you're going to have to do better, guys. You know, mm-hmm. if you're going to try and convince you or me, you're going to have to do better with who you have as your spokesman, number one. And number two, you're going to have to do a heck of a lot better in providing some proof. Yes. And by proof, I don't mean just documentation. I mean, trot out the hardware and let us look at it. Let us poke and prod and do all that sort of stuff. Otherwise, no, I'm not convinced.
Interesting that they're rolling out neocons around this, that like Rubio wants to bomb Iran, for example.
I know. You're right.
It strikes me is interesting. It's, you know, like Havana Syndrome out of Cuba, the strangeness with that. You know, Rubio, who has the former Cuban exile story about his parents. Lou Elizondo, his dad was in the Bay of Pigs Brigade, and you know, Castro kept him in a prison for 2 years. I mean, there's a weird little Cuba, Florida thing in all this.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, massive amount of sightings off the coast of Florida.
Yep. So, including the launch pad for our rockets.
Yes. You know. Cape Canaveral.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. It's an incredible op, you know, and the fact that they have these senators on board is almost the most telling piece of the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. What did they have to do to get on board, or what is in their control files being held as the sword of Damocles over their head? You know, you know, I don't call it Swampington, D.C. for nothing. You know, these people are inveterate liars.
Yeah.
And they're very studied and practiced at it. So, like I say, color me skeptical, you're going to have to do better to the deep state. Much better.
And if the, you know, the kind of main person behind the whole TTSA luau, it turns out to be Chris Mellon, what does that tell us about the nature of this thing?
Well, it tells me that, yeah, banking, high finance have had a stake in this from the start. Because go back to what I said in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations. In order to put into place a hidden system of finance, a la President Truman, and recovering all that gold, the first thing that he did was he put the intelligence agencies directly in the banking business, which, right. You know, Alan Dulles, he's totally familiar with that world.
Yes.
And not only that, but to make it work, you have to have the participation of the major prime banks of the Western financial system to make it work.
Right.
Because they're in on it. And they're in on it for one reason and one reason only. That gives them a secret reserve. And they can balloon and pump and dump to their heart's content. They can rehypothecate, you know, all the standard little tricks of the trade. So I'm not at all surprised to find big banks in the mix. Not at all.
Fascinating. Wow. Joseph, when the report comes out, you're going to have to come back on and we're going to go through what they've laid out there.
I'm sure they'll lay something out there. I mean, they've built this thing up. They have to lay something out there.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm interested to see what sort of shenanigans and what sort of farce they're going to roll out. But like I said at the top of this, I'm increasingly skeptical because of all of this, of the whole ET narrative. I really am. Mm. And, you know, that doesn't mean I'm philosophically opposed to the existence of ETs, but it's looking kind of iffy to me at this juncture. But there we go.
Interesting. Well, they might have to appoint, you know, Biden might have to come out and appoint Chris Mellon as the alien defense secretary.
Look, anything's possible at this juncture. I mean, we basically have a senile grifter in the White House, you know.
Wow.
So anything's possible. I mean, he's not in charge. So it's a committee of some sort behind the scenes.
No question. You know? Does it remind us of, like, Chernenko,
Richard Nixon in the final days,
you know,
running around talking to the pictures in the White House,
right.
which may be happening right now. We don't know, and we're not going to be told if it is. But,
just to sum up the whole picture, what are we looking at going forward with them trying to use this UAP task force to create a UFO threat?
Oh, I think we're looking at another op, another narrative. They're going to drive it, you know, and so much the better if ET actually does show up, you know.
Right.
But to me, we're looking at a narrative and where it's going to go. Maybe they're going to reveal, oh, yeah, we've been in contact with these people for decades and now we're finally admitting it, or, you know. But again, if they're pushing any sort of narrative, I would caution to people to be initially skeptical and keep that skepticism and drill down and examine whatever they say with a fine-tooth comb, and don't expect immediate answers either. Drill into it, because I don't trust them.
No way. Well, they're not very trustworthy.
No, they aren't.
Yeah.
They aren't. You know, they sold us the Warren Commission, and it's been one big narrative after another since then. And, you know, I had my skepticism ingrained into me, as I've said many times on your shows, when I was a boy, and they murdered the president and then came out with the most ridiculous explanation for it in the world. And at that point, I thought, okay, trust is off. You know, turn that off.
It's amazing. It's an amazing arc going from the Kennedy assassination to the COVID op to the UFO, UAP marketing op.
I go back to what Meg Ryan said when the BCCI scandal wrote, when she was still a columnist for Newsweek, and she wrote a column. And she complained, she says, this is like a bad Mozart opera. Everybody appears in disguise, and from one crisis to the next, we're always dealing with the same people. And she, you know, she just listed it. Waco, Ruby Ridge, BCCI, savings and loan scandal, Kennedy, Watergate, you know, on and on it goes. And it's always the same people.
Nice.
So do I trust them? No.
Wow.
No.
Unbelievable. Joseph, it's great to see you.
Thanks for having me back on, Daniel.
We're looking forward to the new books when they're in the pipeline.
When they're in the pipeline, however long that may be, I'm kind of on a writing hold right now because, like I say, I want to see where this is all going to go.
Yeah.
And if it's going the way I think it's going, then I'm going to take the gloves off and just write what I want to write and say what I want to say. And it won't be good news for a lot of people.
I like it. I'll be looking forward to that. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, sir.
Thank you for joining us, everyone. We'll be back next Friday, July 23rd at 8 p.m. Eastern for a new episode of the Dark Journalist X Series. See you soon.
Werner von Braun, who is at present the chief of the guided missile division of the Army's Rocket Center at Redstone Arsenal. He was also overall director of the development of the original V-2 rocket.
Now here's a model of my design for a four-stage orbital rocket ship. Compared to the unmanned instrument rocket, it is quite large, but the overall size and weight of the rocket is mainly determined by the 11 tons weight of this top section. This weight dictates the amount of fuel and the numbers of motors needed to produce enough power to equalize the gravitational pull of the Earth. The payload in the top section will consist of 10 crew members plus equipment. Notice the wings, small rocket motor, and landing gears. This is a section that must ultimately return the men to the Earth safely. To produce the energy needed to hurl this stage into the orbit, we need these three additional rocket-powered sections. Here we have a cutaway drawing of our rocket showing the location of the fuel and the motors of each section. The first stage carries 1,060 tons of fuel, and its 29 motors will lift the entire weight of the ship vertically off the ground. The second stage has 8 motors and carries 155 tons of fuel. It will be dropped when its speed has reached 14,300 miles per hour. The next is our third stage, with only one rocket motor and 13 tons of fuel. The third stage gives the passenger section the final kick to attain the orbit. It will not be separated from the passenger section until just before the return flight. The third stage will be left in space, and a very small motor in the winged fourth stage will return the ship to the atmosphere so it can glide back to the base. If we were to start today on an organized and well-supported space program, I believe a practical passenger rocket could be built and tested within 10 years.